Let's all just admit it, all right? I certainly will. Nobody knows what the Fed is going to do and when they are going to do it. But hey, no harm in guessing, right? Inflation economics on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Wednesday, the 19th of August is what the calendar says. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We are going to begin today with a peek behind the curtain, a glimpse, if you will, into the collective psyche of the keepers of the American economy, the members of the Federal Reserve's Interest Rate Setting Open Market Committee. Minutes from their most recent meeting were released today, in which we learned that the FOMC continues to be concerned about a weak global economy as well as lagging inflation here. Exactly when the long-awaited rise in interest rates is going to happen is still, of course, anybody's guess. The Fed, as you may know, has, by statute, two main jobs. The dual mandate, it's called. One is making sure this country is at maximum employment, on which they are doing pretty well and getting better pretty much every month. The other is moderate long-term interest rates and price stability, inflation more commonly. And therein, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, lies the problem.
Numbers out today from the Labor Department say consumer prices are moving at a crawl, up only 0.2% from last year. And that low inflation certainly isn't from lack of trying by the Federal Reserve.
They've printed all this money, right? And people aren't spending it. And they can't make people go out and spend.
Anna Rathbun is director of research at CBIZ Retirement Plan Services. She says there's a risk if the Fed raises rates too soon.
Because if they raise rates while the inflationary pressure is not there and it's too low, it could slip down and become deflation. And when this happens, the Fed runs out of ammunition.
And the Fed is already trying to fight off global pressures.
The fact that we have a global supply chain has actually allowed us to be very sensitive to inflation in other places in the world.
Gennady Goldberg of TD Securities says right now, those pressures from countries like China and Brazil are pushing inflation down here at home, along with other factors. And remember, a little bit of inflation is supposed to be a good thing. Ted Peters used to sit on the Federal Reserve Board in Philadelphia.
Well, you need a little bit of inflation to give companies pricing power and for them to be able to increase their prices. And if they increase their prices and make more money, then hopefully they pass that along to their employees as well.
But today's minutes predict we won't reach the Fed's 2% inflation target anytime soon. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There's a counter on the Ashley Madison website. The company that you might know promises discreet affairs. That counter boasts of more than 38 million anonymous users. Many of those users might not be so anonymous anymore. Hackers have leaked the oh-so-private data of the Ashley Madison users that they got their hands on last month in a hack that is qualitatively different than other big breaches of consumer information. This stolen data is salacious, yes, compromising, possibly. Still valuable, though? Oh, you betcha. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
Doing bad things on the internet 101.
Don't use your real name and email address and all that stuff.
Because John Kindervag, a cybersecurity analyst with Forrester Research, says there is a sad sort of inevitability to these kinds of hacks and no shortage of targets.
I don't think cyber criminals are out there wondering, how will I ever get into certain companies? I think they're just like overwhelmed and go, well, we don't have time to breach every company.
I think it's idealistic to say you can provide absolute privacy.
Michaela Menting is with ABI Research. She says this is a tough line to toe for companies that are premised on privacy. Ashley Madison, yes, but also less risque businesses like health insurers, HR departments, photo storage sites.
You know, it's maybe something you don't want to push forward, right? It's not 100% secure. These are the risks. We can't guarantee, you know, absolute protection.
That's a hard pitch for companies to make. Trust us, but, you know, not too much. Because just as credit cards and social security numbers have value, so does more sensitive information, says Susan Grant at the Consumer Federation of America.
That could be used to impersonate you. It could be used to embarrass you, to trick you into revealing even more information about yourself, or to scam you in some way.
And Grant says, unlike a credit card number that can be easily replaced, when personal information is leaked, there's really no way to undo the damage. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There was an all-too-brief run at finishing in the money on Wall Street today. It didn't quite work out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. NASA released a study today that is kind of mind-boggling. It says that farmers are pumping so much groundwater out of the ground in California's Central Valley because of the drought that parts of the valley floor are sinking as much as 2 inches a month. Water is scarce out here in the West, even in the best of times. But somehow, in the depths of this drought that we're having, new farms are springing up way out in the Arizona desert. Will Stone tells us what's going on.
When Wayne and Glenda Irwin retired to this quiet, barren corner of the Mojave Desert, farming wasn't on their minds. Mostly it was stargazing and protecting their schnauzers from rattlesnakes.
They know to keep their distance whenever there's an encounter. But that's the well down there.
Beyond the Irwin's well house, through the haze, you can just make out tractors peeling through clouds of dust.
You see some green down through there, which is alfalfa, I suspect. And that's when we first started noticing the well drilling.
Red Lake Valley doesn't exactly strike you as the land of plenty, but in the last couple years, dozens of large-scale wells have been drilled and thousands of acres have been turned into farmland. That's making people around here very nervous.
Whoever's got that water, and with the situation that we're in with water, controls that water, they control our destiny here. They really do.
Just look at California's Central Valley, Irwin says, where aquifers are drying up due to generations of pumping. That's not the story here in Kingman, though. Farming never took off, mainly because pulling water out of the ground was too expensive. But with the drought in nearby California and the high price of commodity crops, investors are casting their sights elsewhere.
The water table level is going to drop. You know, there's just no doubt about that.
That's Buster Johnson, a supervisor for the county. He believes the surge in agriculture is jeopardizing the economy of this already water-scarce region.
Because they're going to be water-intensive users, and they'll drop it, and it's their right to take the water. And if it works out at a model plan for them, a business plan that they can make money, they can pull the water, and when it runs out, they can go back to or go on to the next place.
That's because unlike Phoenix or Tucson, where groundwater is regulated, most of rural Arizona is basically the Wild West, with no such restrictions. Kingman depends on the same aquifers as these farms. Some estimate the city could run out of water in as soon as 50 years. So who are these farmers?
I represent a group of investors, mostly public pension funds.
Bob Saul is with Wood Creek Capital, a Connecticut-based investment manager. Here's him speaking at a public meeting earlier this year.
When you're investing for institutions, you really have to use best practices. We're not in the business of trying to, jeopardize anybody's aquifer or their land base.
Saul goes on to call this, quote, the most exciting farmland project in the country. And he's not the only one getting in on the action. A Las Vegas developer is also farming huge tracts of land here. Over the phone, Saul tells me their whole enterprise relies on growing sustainably, not how it's been done in much of California.
Now we have a chance in Red Lake to start over again with brand new soils, brand new water resource, brand new systems.
Saul has closely studied the aquifers and disagrees with the doom and gloom projections. The untouched soil has vast potential for all sorts of crops, he says, mostly to feed the ever-hungry California dairy industry. And not everyone is against the farm. Just chat with rancher Emmett Sturgill, who runs cattle next door.
Was actually happy to hear that they were putting farms in, because the alternative, in my view, would be houses and housetops and dogs and four-wheelers and people cutting my fences.
Sturgill's heard all the rumors. Fears the aquifer will go dry, that this is a covert attempt to seize the water or send it to Vegas. But that doesn't jive with what he's seen.
It looks to me like they're trying to put farms together and then sell the farms to other farmers to make money.
Sturgill says he isn't going to worry. That's unless his wells start going dry. In Kingman, Arizona, I'm Will Stone for Marketplace.
First, it was California a couple of weeks ago with sky-high gas prices despite the falling price of crude. Now gas has spiked in the Midwest as well. Drivers in Michigan, according to AAA, are paying 50 cents more a gallon now than they were just a week ago, and that is with oil closing at 6.5-year lows in New York today. Something is going on, and that something, as it happens, is a series of kinks in the supply chain. Marketplace's Gigi Duban has more now on what happens when refineries go offline.
Refineries shut down all the time. No big deal. It's when there's an unplanned outage at a major one that gas prices spike. Mason Hamilton is an analyst with the U.S. Energy Information Administration.
And so that is sending a very big signal to the market that their supply chains need to adjust accordingly.
These markets in the Midwest are essentially saying, send us gasoline from somewhere else in the Midwest or the Gulf Coast. Just get it to us. How much gas prices increase depends on a few things.
The tightness in the market and the costs of acquiring those new supplies.
And right now, the market is very tight. Stephen Kopitz is managing director of Princeton Energy Advisors.
The reality is that the demand for gasoline is up 6.6% for the latest 4 weeks compared to a year ago. That's a big demand growth in this country, and we haven't seen that in a very long time.
That's pushing oil refineries to the limit. Guy Caruso is senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He says right now, refineries are running at more than 90% capacity.
And any time you're running that many industrial facilities at that high rate, you know, you're vulnerable to disruptions or industrial accidents or breakdowns.
So why not build more refineries to handle demand? Caruso says, for one thing, it's difficult to get environmental permissions. And secondly, it's not been a very profitable business until now. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I love to live on the edge, so I really love to not put on a cape and have that guarantee that not one thing is going to drop.
Who said doing television makeup isn't a risky business? That lady did, that's who. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 162 points today, about 0.9%, 17,348. The NASDAQ off 40 points, 0.8%, finished at 5,019. The S&P 500 down 17 points, also 0.8%, 2,079. Those crude oil prices I talked about, as I said, 6-year lows after data showed a surprise increase in U.S. stockpiles. Thus, Lynn Energy, an independent producer, sank 10.4%. Phillips 66 off nearly 3% today. One good day does not a recovery make in the metals sector. Goldfields Limited, that's a gold miner, jumped nearly 10% today, but it's more than 55.0% below its yearly high. Likewise, Anglo Gold Ashanti, another miner, up more than 10% today, down 60% for the year. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A pause now for some talk about the business of talk among teenagers, specifically, and what passes for talk for them. Mobile messaging on apps like Snapchat and Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, and something called Kik. That's K-I-K. We learned two things about it this morning. One, that umpteen million teenagers in this country are using it. And B, Tencent, the Chinese company behind the Chinese messaging giant WeChat, has sunk $50 million into it with the idea of making it the WeChat of the West. Marketplace's Nova Sappho explains.
Here's how to think of the mobile messaging landscape, says Julie Ask of Forrester Research.
This is just a giant chessboard that about 10 global players are trying to fill in.
Ask says different messaging apps tend to be popular in different countries, and the Tencent Kik deal is a land grab for the U.S. and Canada. That's because messaging apps have not been as widely adopted here, and there's no dominant player yet.
If you have a lot of users, and if you're associated with a company that has a lot of users, you got a better shot.
That's mobile analyst Jeff Kagan. But building a big user base is just the beginning. Making money is all about what comes next. Kik's founder Ted Livingston said as much at a public forum at the University of Waterloo in Canada.
The thing we're thinking about now is what you could build on top of chat. And really what we're looking at as a model for that is what's happening in China. with WeChat.
WeChat, with 400 million active users, has become a platform which offers things like online games, e-commerce, and mobile payments. It also connects users with brands to bring in advertising dollars. The app helped parent company Tencent pull in more than $1 billion in profit last quarter. Kick now wants to do the same.
The question we're asking is, could we leverage that popularity to do sort of the WeChat platform play in the U.S.?
A lot of others are asking that same question. Facebook Messenger, with the biggest share of users, has been building out its platform. Ditto for Snapchat. Julie Ask of Forrester says Tencent and Kick have their work cut out for them.
But it's a very competitive landscape here in the U.S.
We may have gotten a late start, she says, but there's a lot to be gained in catching us up quickly. I'm Nuva Safo for Marketplace.
While Congress tries to figure out what it wants to do with the Iranian nuclear deal that was worked out last month, there are real economic issues on the line, both for Iranians in Iran and the potential lifting of Western sanctions on them, and for the close to 500,000 people of Iranian descent who live in the biggest Iranian community outside that country. It's an upscale part of Los Angeles that locals sometimes call Tehranjilis. Marketplace's Andy Euler went out for a look-see.
I'm walking down Westwood Boulevard, and I duck into a little market in Delhi called Tochal. The market's manager, Todd Kodadadi, meets me at the door.
We are in the Persian Square, the middle of the Persian community. Most of the businesses here is that they have like Persian sign, and also, obviously, we live in the United States. But they have the English sign, too.
It's a pretty opulent part of the city, with jewelry shops and travel agencies at most intersections. There's even a Bravo reality TV series, Shaws of Sunset, that follows this set of Iranian Americans in Los Angeles. Todd worked in computer software when he lived in Iran 15 years ago. He says nowadays he makes his living selling Persian stuff to the Persian community. A lot of his products used to come directly from Iran. Now they import similar products from different countries in the region that aren't under sanctions. Todd tells me he can still taste the difference.
The best zafran is in the world is from Iran. Best pistachio in the whole world is from Iran. Mulberry, the best one is from Iran. We have similar kind from the Afghanistan, but still, I can tell the best one is from Iran.
Next door is Damoka, a three-story warehouse stocked to the brim with Persian rugs.
You can see that carpet is 250,000. The red one is 250,000.
Alex Helmy moved to Los Angeles from Tehran 40 years ago for school. After he got done, he took over the carpet business from his father. He hasn't been able to import Persian rugs since the tightening of sanctions in 2010. While Todd gets the goods for his market by dealing with other countries, Alex deals around his import problems by selling secondhand carpets. The most expensive one in the warehouse will still run you $250,000.
The Persian carpets are the treasures of the world. It's like diamond. It's like art.
But what about his market share? Won't more people get into the business if they can import these rugs?
There's not going to be more people doing it. But the people who are already doing it, they would have an open supply. You see, right now, whatever we sell, we cannot replace. But when the doors opens up, hopefully we can replace them.
In fact, he says if he could get new rugs from Iran, there might be an opportunity for him to open a shop there.
Yeah, so the price right now, as we speak, the prices in inside Persia is much higher than inside United States. We might consider selling our carpets there.
As I continue down Westwood Boulevard, I see some young Iranian Americans snapping selfies next to a shop that advertises Persian pizza. Many in the area tell me this is exactly the sort of thing you might see walking the streets of Tehran. There's a bookshop on the corner that's been here since the early 1980s, and it houses Kitab Corporation.
This company is a publishing company, publish Iranian yellow pages, Iranian pocket yellow pages.
That's the company's founder, Bajan Khalili. He proudly tells me Kitab was the first company to start translating and publishing titles in Persian in America.
I publish more than 500 titles. Also, this company provides information to the Iranian community free of charge.
We start discussing how he ended up here, how he immigrated soon after the Iranian Revolution, and then...
I'm sorry, I got a call from Iran.
Khalili's been in Los Angeles for almost 40 years now. But as he gets up from his desk and shouts some instructions to his employees in Farsi, it seems pretty clear. Being from Iran translates to more than just a language or a zip code. I'm Ady Euler for Marketplace.
We're all probably going to spend more time than we want to in the next year or so looking at politicians' faces, candidates on your TV or your computer screen or your phone screen, what have you. But riddle me this. Why do some of those people look just a little bit, well, better than others do? You might have Chris Blevins to thank for that. She is a makeup artist, and we read about her in the Boston Globe a couple of weeks ago, so we wanted to call her up and see what it's like touching up the faces of some of those top politicians. Chris, thanks for coming on.
It's good to be here.
How did it come to pass that you wound up doing presidential candidate makeup? I mean, it's not your usual career field, I would imagine.
Right. I went to college in London, England, and kind of spent my years as a model growing up and did some modeling over in London and ended up getting a modeling gig with the London School of Makeup, the best makeup school in the world. But I started doing political makeup back in 1991. Actually, my ex-husband met Pat Buchanan's campaign manager in a men's room and mentioned his wife did makeup if they ever need it. And the next day I was doing the cover of Newsweek magazine with Pat Buchanan, and that sort of opened up the door to a great relationship, and I ended up traveling with him. He had a show on CNN. He introduced me to NBC, and my career took off as a result of Pat Buchanan.
Tell me the story of Hillary Clinton's lipstick and your sort of gut in this whole process.
I was working for CNN here in New Hampshire, kicking off the debate cycle. And our
this
first
is
debate.
2007, 2008, right? Last time
this
around.
Is 2007.
Yeah.
And I was responsible as the head makeup artist for the debate. Her assistant held up a red lipstick and said, "Here's her lipstick. This is what she wears." And I just got this terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. And, you know, it was my inner artist. I work very intuitively, you know, when I do art, and I stay in the moment. And that moment was wrong. So I just, you know, courageously looked at her assistant and I said, "You know, I'm not feeling it." And Hillary Clinton just lifted her face to me and she said, "Then do what you feel, Chris."
Wow.
And, you know, it could have gone either way. But the next day, I guess the word was that everyone thought she had a facelift and had never looked better. So kind of put me on the map a little bit as, you know, an artist that can really transform women at the hand of my artistry as well as my product.
This is, though, a business, right? So when you work on, you know, debates or campaigns or whatever, are you freelancing? Is that how it works? Or do they sign you to a long-term contract? Or what's the deal?
I freelance.
Yeah,
I freelance. And I do that so that I can work for all parties, all places, all networks. My company handles the needs for usually about 5 networks for all their makeup needs when they come into New Hampshire. And this has also opened up doors for me over the years to travel nationally with like CNN as their head makeup artist for the special events unit. So in the 2007-2008 election, I was cross country with them for 18 months on all debates and both conventions as their lead makeup artist.
When they sit down in your chair and you put the cape thing on them so they don't get, you know, makeup
I don't use
on
a cape.
Them. Really? So you're working without a net?
Yeah, I love to live on the edge. So
wow.
I really love to not put on a cape and have that guarantee that not one thing is going to drop. And I've never had a problem.
Oh, come on. So, never? You've been doing this for 28 years?
Yeah, no, never. Never had a problem with lipstick on anything or powder on a collar or anything.
Well, I don't want to jinx you, so I'll let you go here. Chris Blevins, we got her in Manchester, New Hampshire. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in which a simple news item says a whole lot about a whole lot of things. From the CBS television station here in Los Angeles, this item. You know the big film in theaters right now, Straight Outta Compton? Turns out you can't actually go see that movie in the city of Compton because there are no movie theaters in town. Disinvestment is what the economists call that. That's all we got today. The Dow Industrial's off 162 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ down 40 points, about 0.8%. The S&P 500 off 17 points, 0.8% there as well. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.